have absolutely, I have no content, like, I have not thought through anything in this episode, so it's gonna be fun.
That's cool. That's
You
cool.
haven't seen episode 4 yet, Rachel.
No, I haven't
Yeah.
yet.
No.
Either way.
Have you guys both seen episode 4
No,
already?
I haven't seen
No.
episode 4. No.
I'm
I will
They put
watch
it out
it.
early.
Yeah, they put it out early. Max reckons because of the Super Bowl, which makes sense.
I was like, I kept seeing videos flash up saying episode 4, and I was like, that can't be out yet, right? Is it released? But if it's released early, that makes sense.
So I'm looking forward to that. But of course, the thing that we all want to know is, Max, how did Kelsey respond to Egg?
Oh, yes.
Well, I think she started. So she like the. I think the hints were pretty obvious the whole time, and she really like started to like question things when the fortune teller woman tells the fortunes and tells Egg's fortune, and she was like. Okay, so does that happen? She asked me. She's like, does that happen? I'm like, well, I'm like, just watch the show,
Just
and then at the end, she's like, that's stupid, but then she liked it, but she just like,
was
she's just a little bit cynical. It was a little bit cynical mood, but no, she clarified that she likes the show. She just was surprised. She
She
definitely was
was.
surprised.
Well,
She
that.
was, even with all the foreshadowing.
She picked up on it. Like, I will give her like credit that she knew something was up with him, but she didn't know like what she wouldn't have guessed that he was a Targaryen necessarily. But she definitely thought there was something more going on with Egg.
I thought the
Oh, I
fact that he
love
was,
that. That's fascinating.
yeah, because I thought the fact that he was like a bald boy, like I thought that was it. I thought that gave it away. That would,
Well, she definitely thought something was weird with that. She's like, why is he bald?
yeah.
But I didn't
As I said, I
answer,
think
and she just got mad at me for not answering her.
it's again, I can't remember what the term is when because you know something, you just assume that it's obvious to others. I think the bold characters being potential Targaryens, something that's very like well established in the books and hinted at in the main Game of Thrones main series, and obviously they use it. The only time I've actually seen it canonically put to screen
Varys. No, I'm joking.
is
People do think
in
that.
House of the Dragon with what's he called who ran off with his boyfriend.
Lenor Velaryon?
Adam, or, yeah,
Yeah.
Lenor.
And I can't think of any other instances of it, but I feel like I'm so very aware of that being like obviously a Targaryen would shave their head in order to hide their identity. That's so blatantly obvious to me, but I think if you're experiencing the story for the first time, you just think, yeah, that's weird. What's up with that kid? Yeah, I'm that's such a fascinating reaction to be like, yeah, that's stupid. I'm enjoying it, but that seems like it seems like I can imagine it feeling kind of like jumping the shark if you haven't into all of the foreshadowing.
Yeah, a bit. And then she went back and thought about that prophecy some more. And then she just kept on asking me follow-up questions. She's like, so what happens then? So what then? He dies in fire? And I'm like, well, yeah, he's this character that they talked about in Game of Thrones, and she actually hasn't seen Game of Thrones,
Oh,
so
okay. I've been trying to remember
she
because it's been
watched
a
House of the
while.
Dragon with me. She watched season 1 and 2 of that, and she's watched this with me so far, but she has not seen Game of Thrones yet.
I'm trying to
She's more,
remember
it's not her genre, really.
how far up the timeline is Summerhall in terms of if we go back from Danny? Is it two
Well,
generations or three generations?
it was right before Rhaegar was born,
It's
was Summerhall.
Right.
her great Egg is her great great grandfather or great grandfather?
It's her
Great.
great great in well wait no sorry he Egg is her great grandfather in the books, but I think in the show they actually do omit the generation between Egg and Aerys.
Okay.
So I think the canons are a little bit different, but
Oh, okay.
we'll see when we get to it because obviously he's not of grandfatherly slash great grandfatherly age at the moment. So
yeah,
to see
that's far away. I just kept on saying, I'm like, that's like years in the future. They're not going to talk about that in this show.
No. No, not
that's such a fascinating reaction. That's so interesting.
Not unless they do something really, because like George R. R. Martin says that he's got 10 of these stories in him.
Yeah.
No, well, I mean,
I think it's interesting because obviously the three main stories that have come out so far is very, you know, it's learning political intrigue. It's very two relatively or very naive characters exploring the world, and then obviously by the time we get to Summerhall, Egg as a character is very different. There's a reason why that prophecy was so ominous. Like, to get to that place, like, I can see how it would take many books to get to that place, particularly as I said, the first three books from the series, as far as I'm aware of them, are very, they're learning and processing for the characters, but it's by no means, this is where the bad stuff's going.
Yeah. And with, I can't remember much about Egg's like years as king, but the Mad King Ares, like, he was quite old when he actually went mad, right? He wasn't mad all his.
I don't know. He's Tywin's age, I think. I think he and Tywin
very
are
similar, yeah.
Supposed to be the same age, at least in the books.
So he wasn't. He was mad in the later years of his life, but he wasn't like. But he wasn't born mad, was he? Was he? I think.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
So it might.
I think he went more mad. He went more mad later on. Mm. Definitely, because
it was progressive, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was. Probably you know, the typical like Daemon from House of the Dragon or Arian. Type like
Hungarian
psychos, but not like evil until later, from what I understand.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was thinking about this earlier today, right? What I'm really actually quite enjoying about Night of the Seven Kingdoms in a broader way is, and you don't get, is that actually, despite it being a relatively light avenue of Game of Thrones, you're actually getting quite a lot of political intrigue in a way that you kind of don't expect, and a lot of world building, because the whole Ashford thing in the Reach, that's not, as far as I'm aware, outside of this tournament, particularly consequential. It's just, it could be anywhere, it seems. But all of the people that come have, you know, like, we've already seen Tyrells, Baratheons, what's the other one? Dondarrions, obviously Targaryens. There are Beesburys, the apple cider people. All of these different houses, factions, and how they intermingle and operate, you know, and operate. And we'll no doubt see more of that in the next three episodes till the end of this series. I reckon we've seen more political intrigue amongst the families, as well as the fact that, of course, with the Targaryens, they don't have dragons, so they have to be politically savvy at this point, because if they're not, then they get fucked, because there's you've already had the Blackfyre Rebellion. I think there's a rebellion that happens in the novellas here, is there a few other battles here and there that kind of?
So I think the Blackfyre Rebellion, the first Blackfyre Rebellion, was like 10, 20 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
There's definitely already been multiple Blackfyre Rebellions.
I think
down with you, Blackfyre Bastard.
Yeah.
There's a couple other events that are like referred to as Blackfyre Rebellion that go down the line. I think four of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely been politically unstable for the Targaryens since they lost their dragons.
Yeah, well, no one seems to really like them, and they. I mean,
join the fact that
Raymond Fosway's speech, that was
Fosway,
I loved every word of that. That was some great writing.
Dunk's reaction to it, also amazing.
Ooh. Yeah.
The bit at the end was like, oh, the bit about the tits was from Stefan. It's like that fucking slogan. <isn't it? laughs> And yeah, I think it's, I mean, obviously that primes Dunk a little bit for what's about to happen. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it also feels like that's kind of what everyone thinks, but is too scared to say. You know, a little bit of Dutch courage going on there, a little bit, you know. But I think I would hazard a guess to say that that's probably the general consensus of most people that aren't Targaryens, right? Do you reckon?
Imagine there's a sort of like, there's some good ones, I suppose, sort of attitude, but most of the time, fucking awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of vibes. I think that being the general consensus.
They feel that way, considering history.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, they, you know, they are seen as invaders, really, right? Even at this, do you reckon at this point, because this is hundreds of years now, is it hundred? Yeah, about, it's hundreds of years since Aegon's conquest.
The Targaryens lived on Dragonstone for hundreds of years, even before Aegon's conquest. So they, I think the Targaryens have been living like around Westeros for like 400 years or something like that.
It's also, it goes to the in House of the Dragon when they brought the dragon through the city and was like, politically, that could be, woo, we killed dragon, but what it said to the people was, look, these people, like, dragons are just beasts, and therefore Targaryens are just human. When the Targaryens were all these ethereal, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, purple-eyed, you know, dragon riders, they had a sort of ethereal quality to them, and they seemed above it all. Now, I can see, potentially with Dornish, know, marriage pacts and such like, there's less innate, like, small folk, I don't know, worship's not quite the right word, but like,
oh yeah, reverence.
You can see how, yeah, there's less reverence, there's more, oh, they really are just bastards, huh, type vibes.
Yeah.
I can see, you know, it's so interesting to see a small folk perspective, and even, you know, small folks crossing paths with lower lords.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's a good way of doing it. I like it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Right. So I'm scanning through. I'm just trying to remember what actually was in this episode now.
The first sequence with the horse.
The horse. There we go.
Like,
yeah,
taking the horse out and you know, training it was genuinely delightful. Like, the first, like, two-thirds of this episode is just delightful Dunk and Egg shit.
Oh, yeah.
It's really lovely. It's so lovely.
Yeah.
It's pleasant to be around, which is so unlike any other Game of Thrones series. I don't think there's any point in any of the other Game of Thrones series where I'm just like, I'm enjoying being here and chilling out with these characters.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, I think they even sort of almost reference that themselves by saying, I could quite enjoy being here. And he goes, well, you are here.
Just sitting in the grass. And I don't know if I said this in any of the other episodes, but like, the scenery is so beautiful, like realistically beautiful. Like, I feel like I could actually just go camping like where these places are. And like, the shot of like 2 minutes where he's leading the horse through at the sunrise is one of the most beautiful shots of the whole series.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it proves they don't need to spend $10 million an episode to make something that looks good.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think it even has a negative return, because I think that they over-focus on the spectacle and not enough on the characters, you know? I mean, to be fair, Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, really well cast. So, and I think at times, only at times, they don't make the best of that, but I think I think they kind of got their head around that with Night of the Seven Kingdoms, and I think they did
it's
kind
really
of...
It's really interesting seeing the lessons learned between each series.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like it's evolving in a good way.
Yeah, every... I reckon every episode, every new series of Game of Thrones gets better than the last. Like, I think this is better than House of the Dragon, as much as I like House of the Dragon, And I think both of those are better than Game of Thrones.
At least from a starting standpoint, like I feel like I could 100% recommend this, and I have, like, to my sister. I think you'll actually like it. And she's like, oh, I don't like Game of Thrones stuff. I don't really, it's not my thing. I'm like, I think you will genuinely enjoy this.
Do you like projectile diarrhea? Sorry.
Well, I said there's some juvenile humor she maybe wouldn't enjoy. She's a geriatrician. She's probably seen it in real life. But I could genuinely recommend this. I think House of the Dragon is a slightly harder sell just because of the nature of the protagonists and the fact that it is kind of incest core. But I will say it's, in terms of representation, in terms of feeling like there's genuinely different voices behind the screen and in front of the screen, House of the Dragon feels better than Game of Thrones did.
Well, I mean, House of the Dragon feels... for want of a better term, quite incestuous. Like, it's quite...
it's incest school.
It's all about the Targaryens, and that is not the most interesting part of Game of Thrones. What's the most interesting part of Game of Thrones is the moving and shaking about all the different aristocratic families, and you get that really well presented here, as you do at these kind of events, and I think it nails... In the way that they aim to do it, everything that I like about Game of Thrones, the intrigue probably doesn't go as deep as your Peter Baelish's and Varys's, because they just don't have that time, and the depth of writing is not quite as there. But it's certainly great, you know.
I think it's worth maybe putting in a comparison to say an Agatha Christie, a Poirot. Agatha Christie versus the modern Sherlock.
Yeah.
Where I feel like classic episode of Poirot, the seeds are there and it's simple enough that you can follow it, and then you get a satisfying conclusion. Whether or not it was too easy to guess, who cares? It doesn't care as much about... I say this show cares about... It feels like it's willing to do setup and payoff without having to feel obligated to do shock factor.
Yeah.
Obligated to do, subversion. Subversion is great. And Game of Thrones obviously had a reputation for doing subversion based on Ned's death. But the whole point of Ned's death, at least where it was presented from, and particularly in the books, it's really almost blatant in the books, is he continuously made the wrong decisions.
Yeah.
He continuously went against, maybe not common sense, but, self...
political...
political survival.
That's it, yeah.
And knowingly put himself and his family in a difficult position with almost every single step he did. And so it felt like the killing of a main character feels emotionally very subvertive.
Yeah.
But in terms of plot, was very directly, you could see the cause and effect.
Yeah.
I feel like, obviously, towards the end of Game of Thrones, they then decided that it would be more effective to do subversion over cause and effect. And I feel like this, be simple. It's better to have all the things in a row, and then you get that payoff, and you're like, yes, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't need twists and turns when you can have really good, simple maths.
Yeah.
It feels, because I feel like it's respecting me more as an audience member. It's not pulling out the rug just for the sake of pulling out the rug. It feels like if a rug gets pulled, I'll be like, oh, that makes sense. In the same way that the egg reveal, even that we knew we were spotting all of the factors and the evidence.
I'm straight up
on
saying,
a rewatch, even if you didn't know it, on a rewatch you could be like, oh yeah, it's so obvious.
I still find this to be it's not a serious reveal. You know, maybe it's a bit of fun. Maybe, you know, I mean, it gives it away in Game of Thrones if you switched on enough. I don't know. Part of me even feels like the blurb on the book or something like that gives it. I don't know. To me, it's never felt.
I can see how if you didn't know, you wouldn't know genuinely. I can. Yeah.
Okay. But
it
also,
does make sense to me.
Yeah. All of that stuff aside, though, the
setup's really good.
Yeah. But the fundamentals are really good as well. Like, just literally the casting, the character acting, the small moments, which is what a lot of this is all about. They just nail it in all the ways. Like, it's just, just the little brother, big brother kind of dynamic that they've seemed to have got going on. Even though it's only been, 3 days or something? Is it basically an episode a day over the tournament?
I think it's, like, some of those days kind of jump over, because there's definitely been, like, drinking scenes and sleeping scenes and sort of thing kind of overlapping with each other. Mm. It's hard to tell.
But it definitely seems, well, it's a multi-day tournament and it's a multi... Yeah, so they're getting to know each other over a relatively short amount of time, but they're spending all the time together, you know?
Yeah.
It's...
I can see, like, so even from not an audience perspective, I can see how Unk wouldn't have worked it out.
Mm.
And regardless of how the audience has or has not worked it out, I find it interesting the fact that they've set up a really good, compelling character juncture for Dunk with this reveal.
Yeah.
Even if we as the audience are going, oh, that was kind of silly, or I saw it coming, or I didn't see it coming, the fact that Dunk didn't.
Yes.
I'm really excited to do that. I'm really excited to see how he reacts to that and what his feelings are, because it's going to be complicated. Particularly as he, has now experienced kind of the worst of the Targaryens.
Yeah, I think it might complicate things, and but also, of course, at the beginning of the episode, we see what's the name of the knight now? The one-eyed guy,
Robin Riesling.
That's it. Yeah.
Wonderfully mad. Like, honestly, his dialogue was
just speaks in a third person.
Yeah.
Do you think when the broken spear went into his eye, it also damaged his brain?
It's certainly possible.
Yeah, it's not going to have made him smarter, is it? It's not going to have made him less mad. So, definitely. Although that being said, I don't know. Like, I mean, you kind of have to be a bit mad to do fucking jousting in the first place, right?
Yeah. So.
We're gonna see more of him, and he's
very interesting. I'll be interested to see how much he plays into the main story.
This particular story, he plays a substantial role, but I think he thinks he is the embodiment of the warrior from the seven things. I think that's what he means when he says we, as in, like, he means himself, but I also think he means, like, the warrior. Like, I think he thinks he's the warrior.
I'm assuming he gets the equivalent of, like, berserker rage when he does marshalling and just, sees red, and he kind of sees that aspect of himself as an alter ego.
Or
it's like fun.
Definitely. I love the bit where they're doing voices with each other. Oh, the songs as well. There's two great songs in here.
Oh, yes, yeah, there is.
The Alice song and the song which was about, like, different. It kind of felt like the, like a ruder version of the King song. My mum can reel off, but I've never been able to remember. Which, like, it's... It must be, like, you can you imagine, like, it's hard enough for me to remember the British kings, who were mostly either they've got numbers after their names.
Oh yeah. It goes Edward, Henry, George, Elizabeth, George, Henry, George.
Can you even imagine keeping track of the Targaryen names and their relationship to each other?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the, the same deal.
Nuts.
Right?
And I love it. I love that that's a very kind of real world thing that then has been applied to Game of Thrones.
I think George R. R. Martin actually did that pretty, like, deliberate, like, as in, like...
Oh, I'm sure it was an homage.
Because it's, well, it's what like the, they say, like one of the rules of writing is don't have names that can be confused. And this is the like just flying in the face of that rule as well, which I think George R. R. Martin kind of likes to do in the way that he likes to do, you know, like he likes to, he homages Lord of the Rings a lot, but at the same time, there are bits of this that he does completely differently to Tolkien, again on purpose, right? Like he's kind of like
he very much wants to subvert the tropes that were set up, of the classic fantasies, which sometimes is really fun to watch, and sometimes feels like it's like alternative for the sake of alternativeness. It depends on, I think. When it's done well, it's done really, really well. And sometimes George R.R. does it much, much better in the book than it is then presented on screen. Particularly when you're dealing with that level of nuance, when you're dealing with kind of respectful kind of tropicism. That's a very hard thing to do well and also make it compelling.
Yeah, yeah. And
you can either get too meta or too miserable. Sometimes George R.R. goes to meta or miserable. And sometimes the Game of Thrones series entirely missed the point.
Yeah, definitely.
Those thought processes. I mean, obviously, John being I think, the primary one I think of, because the whole point of John's death and resurrection, assuming John does resurrect, technically he hasn't in the books. I think part of that thing was George R.R. really wanted to criticize Gandalf's death and how Gandalf came back basically unchanged.
Yeah,
depending on how you read the book, Gandalf, I think, in my opinion, came back pretty changed, and there's a lot of character changes that happened, not just change of, you know, he didn't just get dazzed.
I suspect, now I've not read the Lord of the Rings books, but, and tell me if I'm talking out my ass on this one, but I feel like the Gandalf the Grey turning into Gandalf the White is like a biblical reference to, like, was it Terebims and Ferebims or whatever they're called? You know, the various different types of angels. Because is it the Maelar? So
he is an angel equivalent in that he is a Maelar. I will say that Tolkien was very actively like, this is not a religious allegory. I do not write religious allegories. I write excuses for me to write languages. And I enjoy mythology.
Yeah, but this is...
He might have unwittingly taken inspiration.
I never know what to make of this, because Tolkien does say that. He also says it's not a war allegory, but... it obviously is to a degree, and I don't think Tolkien is. I think Tolkien's. I don't know. Like he's obviously. I mean, obviously, I don't know what's going through his head, right? And if you've spent, you know, some relatively important years of your life in, you know, fighting a war or anywhere else, like, that's obviously going to reflect in how you view the world and how you write your characters. And I think, and I'm only kind of sort of, you know, I'm not super confident in what I'm about to say here, but when George R. R. Martin was writing, not George R. R. Martin, when J.R.R. Tolkien is writing, Christianity and Christian fables and, you know, Dante's Inferno-y type stuff, so, like, writings around Christianity were a much more bigger and prominent part of culture than they are today. So when you think of, like, mythical hierarchies and mythical structures and how mythical worlds are put together, for us, we've got this entire plethora of media from all over the world, all over times, all different, you know, varieties, but what all of the sort of supernatural stuff that Tolkien was drawing from, you know, was a lot more limited. You know, you got ethereal legends, but that was also based heavily in Christianity, you know, and things like Dante's Inferno, which of course is you know, Christian stuff, Christian fan fiction, some might say. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here.
I think he took a lot. Obviously, you know, when you're talking about author intention, you can go down a lot of rabbit holes of, you know, where their background is, what their education is, and what their basic moral and ethical standpoints are. From what I understand of Tolkien's primary inspirations, he loved a lot of classics. So you're talking Roman and Greek mythology.
Okay, yeah, like
that sort
Iliad
of
and stuff,
more yeah. Iliad. And I think he took a lot of inspiration from that level of mythology, and like I think that was part of what he, like particularly my understanding of the Silmarillion. That's a very like, you know, gods interacting with men on Earth and them going on quests to do things and moving one object for another, and Lower Mentor appears upon the mountain.
That makes a lot of sense because you got Saruman, Christopher Lee, who actually did meet Tolkien, which I always find to be quite.
And Tolkien said, I believe the lore is that Tolkien told him that he would play Gandalf and if they made a movie, and Peter Jackson didn't follow through with that, but made him Saruman instead.
I mean, he did a great job. that makes a lot of sense because, yeah, people like Saruman, who is also a Maia. Am I right, Jenny?
I think so.
he's very fallible in the story as well, in the same way that Greek and Roman gods are, aren't they?
Yeah. So, like, it's less like if you were going with the kind of Anglo-Christian view of that, he'd be the equivalent of a fallen angel and then a raised angel in Gandalf, which doesn't really fit the kind of the framing that kind of lead to the world of Lord of the Rings. My point, going back to the point which was to do with Gandalf's resurrection, like, George R. has been very outspoken about how much he hates the fact that Gandalf came back basically new and improved and shiny rather than traumatised and bleak and miserable, and that death didn't have an effect on him, which, given that a lot of the Lord of the Rings story overall is about the tragedy of trauma, and he, you know, eventually everything will die. But the fact that the Game of Thrones series then basically did exactly the thing that George R. R. was.
What with Jon Snow?
Really, with Jon Snow, kind of it solidifies the point that I feel like Game of Thrones missed a lot of the core aspect of what the story was going to say. And then I feel like House of the Dragon learnt a lot. And this show really, I think, has cracked that nut on trying to actually tell the story that was intended.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's more explanation for it with Gandalf than there is with Jon Snow. I don't know, maybe.
I mean, also, Gandalf is an immortal, like, the rules of the universe are completely separate.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
Gandalf is an immortal being that was sent down by the gods and is a all-powerful wizard dude. And Jon Snow is a human man, got stabbed 7 times
also,
by human men.
Is the Balrog a Maia, or is it something else?
He's a beast of Morgoth. Again, I wish my sister was here to add to this conversation, because she would actually be able to probably tell something more fundamental. I need to. We're currently rereading Lord of the Rings. The two of us, when we get together, we read chapters to each other out loud.
That is so adorably Jenny.
That's one of us. We'll camp and we'll pass the book over every other chapter. It's taking us a while to read it because we only do it when we are chilling out and there's nothing else to do. I don't think we'll do that with Silmarillion. So my knowledge of the Silmarillion might be a bit limited. And if we were to do that with Game of Thrones, we'd still be doing it when we're 97.
Yeah.
Well, then
we'll do it with the Hedge Knight.
Yeah. The Hedge Knight isn't like... my mum really likes the Hedge Knight. Was it the three? What's all three of them called again? Night of Seven Kingdoms, right? That's the series of the short stories, right? And this is the Hedge Knight.
You can buy them on all three in one collection.
Which I'm assuming is going to expand into 6 or 10.
We'll see.
Well, that's what George R. R. Martin's been saying.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Very nervous. He's never going to finish all these unfinished projects. He's got so many unfinished projects.
There's a part of me that thinks that there's a greater chance of him writing 10 of these stories than there is of him finishing Song of Spring.
Yes, but also I don't think there's a very high chance of him managing to get out another 7 of these. We'll see.
See, a lot of the framework for all of this is already in place. Like, you kind of already know where the story is going. You've just got to come up with some adventures and characters and dialogue along the way, right? Or am I really...
Just that.
Like, it's... I mean, that's... He's already... He's pre-cracked the nut that he can't crack with Game of Thrones.
He's pre-cracked the egg.
Ah, ba-dum-tsh.
He's already fried that omelette.
Yeah, okay.
There's goose eggs in this episode.
Goose eggs.
That breakfast looks... Those breakfast sandwiches look pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, the breakfast looks so good.
Yeah.
So good. Also, the eggs interaction... I must have talked about this before. I've probably talked about this multiple times. So there's the egg story, which is a linguistic joke story written in Old English or Middle English about, for the standardization of British English, a shipmate traveling up from Portsmouth intending to go to the Netherlands got waylaid by a storm and ended up in the north. And so they had to then ask for supplies. And there's an entire very witty interaction between the ship captain and a good wife while he's trying to ask for eggs. He doesn't understand what he's asking for. And he has to get someone else to translate that he wants eggs, even though they're still in England. It's this wonderful linguistic kind of joke story about linguistics and how even people who are in the same continent can speak with such different dialects that you can't understand them. And that's what the goose eggs story scene reminded me of. It's a very classic English literature thing. I must have talked about it before because it's very funny. But yeah, it reminded me of that there's someone who's selling eggs, presumably middle of Westeros, and seemingly can't work out that someone wants his eggs.
Yeah.
One thing I'll give to that to J.R.R. Tolkien that he definitely has up on George Martin is the linguistics background. I wish there was a little more thought put into the language they speak. Is it the language of the Andals? Is that where, it's English to us, but I think in universe, is it the language of the Andals or something? It just, there could be more there. I know there's some cool stuff they did with Valyrian and Dothraki, but I think that was mostly the TV show. People worked on the TV show that fleshed that stuff out.
Yeah.
But have you ever read the foreword on Lord of the Rings? It's so funny. Is basically J.R.R. being like, look, people keep asking about hobbits because I published The Hobbit. So here I put in a bunch of stuff about the hobbits because people seem to like the hobbits. But you know what? I wrote this book because I just wanted to make up languages and explore literary language kind of creation. And now I have to create this whole backstory to make the language that I created work. All I wanted was to talk about language, and it's so nerdy and adorable.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by languages, so that's something I do appreciate about that.
We haven't actually talked about one of the big, we've not talked about the big sort of spine of this episode, really. Bright Flame, Arian Targaryen. So towards the beginning of the episodes, we see like the first jousting, where the first joust is that hang on, did we see the first jousting? No, that was the last episode, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So this was the joust episode. We've seen some kind of...
Well, we saw like, there's like a montage there.
In
this episode. Montage last episode. And that seemed to be like a... The montage that we saw seemed to be multiple people on the field all at once. Well, this one was like, and that was like maybe the opening challenge because it was at nighttime as well.
That's it.
This
yeah.
was the first daytime one-on-one, and also started off with some pretty blatant, unchivalrous behaviour.
Poor horsey.
Poor horsey. The horsey took forever to die. I thought the horse had already bled out before the guy walked up with the axe. Poor horsey.
This is this.
Did you guys
is...
see the behind the scenes with that? How they filmed that? It was pretty cool.
Oh no, how'd they do it?
No, I haven't.
So it was the horse like really like fell through the fence, like it was like a breakaway fence that they did, and then the horse just sort of like they can command the horse to like lie down and just like filming it like trying to get itself back up and then they CGI'd in the lance and
okay,
it's pretty cool. I think you should check it out.
You do notice what's the king called again? Not the king, the hand. That's is that Maker?
Baylor.
Maker's the other one. Yeah, Baylor
Breakspear.
He's a bit nervous watching this because he knows that Arian is basically
a bit of a scheming shit.
Yeah, knobhead. Yeah. And he's like, shit, this is just going to make us all look bad. And boy, it like, does.
He also, like, it's almost like he's deliberately trying to fuck with his uncle. Like, he looks him in the eye during that whole sequence. Like, it seems like he's kind of picking up trouble with the small folks just because he wants to.
Yeah, and he definitely takes note that, you know, his father isn't there. He thinks, oh, my uncle won't do shit about it, so I'm gonna like
this is an odd one because he's a prince, but he's not a prince in line to the throne, or in, you know, he's not in direct succession to the throne. So
it's princes and brother of the
He's the second son of a fourth son, so he's nowhere. He's only two steps ahead of Egg in the line to the throne, which Egg's pretty far down.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a proper family dynamic, Baylor shouldn't have to take any shit of that, really.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
royalty.
There we go. But you know, I think regardless, he does feel like, yeah, like you can see the nervousness of like, because Baylor's obviously, he's politically savvy and he's like, look, we're here because we have to be seen to be, smart, attentive, present, speaking with people, all that kind of stuff. And then Arian's just like, yeah, but I'm a Targaryen, I'm a prince, da 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 da, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want because everyone, you know, answers to me. And yeah, it's that sort of conflicting ideas between sort of the two types of Targaryens, I guess. I mean, there's a bit of
coin.
I would say coin. There's a Venn diagram with some overlapping, because I think some people like Daemon from House of the Dragon, he's a little bit, I'll do what the fuck I want, but at the same time, he is also politically savvy. Like, I think he, you know, he's a bit of both in that regard, but like,
you can be a shit while still being smart, or you can be a shit while being stupid.
Arian's just a stupid shit,
which is appropriate for the show. I do appreciate that so far we've had at least one just childlike joke every episode. So you know, we obviously had the tree.
Yeah.
Pardon me, right on cue to burp on audio. I just ate a lot of food. Like the tree scene in the first one, and obviously Sir Alec.
I like that there's like so many Targaryens that we get to see like such a wide array of them. Like at this time, like they're their most numerous in like number of living Targaryens.
I think that's also very telling of the state of politics at this point. The fact that the Targaryens, we talked about them having to be more politically savvy and showing good faith and all these jazz. But also, they've got an heir and a spare 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 and a spare. Like, it's a very stable dynasty at this point. So there is a certain level of, you know, I'm not, like, the princes can fuck around and find out because they are still royalty, but they're not going to become the king.
It's political marriage fodder, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's backups.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, this is kind of a time of revelry. It's not a time of war. Obviously there are Targaryen bastards out and about. But, you know, at least at this particular point, let's have a tourney and chill out because of overspend money on a girl's birthday.
Who never really makes it much into the show.
No, bless her.
But
bastards and whatnot. Did you find it interesting? There was, again, a throwaway line from Egg about black hair growing on his stones.
Oh, yeah.
Which, obviously, is just a joke in and of itself. But as a Targaryen who... Clearly, like, he's done more than one reference to Targaryen bastards and whatnot. Is he concerned that the fact that the curtains don't match the cuffs, there might be some genetics that are at play?
Well,
I think that's something that you might grow up just general paranoia as a Targaryen.
I'm not super familiar with ball hair. It's not. You know, I know my own.
I mean, it's more the question of, like, so much of, like, essentially, like, Game of Thrones and Song of House and Fire has talked about genetic traits along family lines.
Well, the thing is, I don't.
I mean, it's just a joke, but it was one of those ones where I was like, is this, why would he bring it up?
In terms of color,
it could be relevant somewhere.
I
thought it was a funny interaction that Dunk was like, it's odd you're telling me.
Yeah.
I mean, that too, I was like, this is the trouble with all of these series. I like to read too much into the fucking details and then I end up on tangents that I shouldn't.
So part of this could be something to do with the fact that the old Targaryens would intermarry a lot more because they valued consolidating their power a lot more. But now, because they don't have dragons, the marriage alliance is substantially more beneficial to them. And, for example, 20 or so years ago, they married into the Dornish family. So the Dornish kept their princes, as it were. But the Dornish being, you know, sort of Mediterranean, darker hair, generally sort of darker features... mixing with the Targaryens. So the Targaryens have got a bit more genetic diversity these days. So, like, as we see with Baelor, he doesn't quite look like what you might think of as a Targaryen. But again, that's probably because they're not as inbred as they used to be. Maybe. Yeah. There's a little bit more variety. But I've always imagined...
more variety. I was more thinking about, like, how Egg might have esteem issues or... Like, imagine growing up in a family where the expectation is to look a certain way as a developing child might think, oh, there's something wrong with me because this is happening.
Yeah. I mean, that's very typical.
Well, I think Egg does, I mean, other than maybe the black ball hair, does like the stereotypical Targaryen, which is why they Darren shaved his head.
Well, does it? Is he lying about the color of his ball hair? Is it like, yeah, my black ball hair? Yeah, like, is that
so
normal? or do Targaryens just have blonde hair but black pubes? Like, is that just a thing they
do
have?
The curtains match the cuffs?
Is that just a thing? Can blonde, like, I don't know, like, do, like, I know, I don't want to get too much into the details, but, like, I've known gingers with ginger pubes.
As far as I'm aware, generally speaking, if you have a certain hair type, your body overall will have a similar hair type.
But blonde people, write in. Is that universal? Is that a given, though?
With blonde hair, for example, naturally blonde hair that is exposed to sunlight will become lighter than other parts of body hair.
Mm-hmm.
But the general, what your body produces is usually consistent across.
Okay.
From my understanding, I am not
hair
specialist.
Yeah, we're not puberticians, that's for sure. But
does your carpet match the Drake Bacon comment?
I did not mean to dig my hole or dig this hole all the way to Australia. Like, I feel like this like a throwaway gag line that I thought was interesting for.
I mean, I don't think it was a throwaway gag line. It's a genuine clue. I just don't know what they're trying to do with it.
I think you're thinking deeply about it, like Egg was thinking deeply about this Alice song.
Yes.
I thought that was a good meta.
I think we're having a deep conversation about something that maybe wasn't that deep. But
for the Alice song, I think was an interesting, like, philosophical moment, to be honest, because...
Yeah, it was.
You know, that's not being defined by your disability, is it?
No. Good for her.
I don't necessarily understand... what specifically makes you a good bum fister? Do you need to put the word bum in front of fister for that one? A fisting person, a fists woman.
my lord, I have brought the fist woman.
A three fingered fisting, but
again, not something I'm educated in enough to comment.
Is anyone? maybe that's an internet search for incognito mode, perhaps. I don't know, but I mean to be honest, I like that they drew a metaphor out of it, but I think it was also of course Lionel Baratheon's cameo for this episode as well, where he was up there with Dondarrion.
Mm-hmm.
Ginger Dondarrion. Lionel Baratheon seems to be rather drunk for most of this, but you know, whatever.
I like that he's having a grand old time.
he's just enjoying the tourney.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's like his Burning Man, I suppose.
That is that seems very, very apt.
I do wonder if the question is he like this all the time everywhere he goes, or is this just like his time to kind of, you know, completely go nuts with his bros? Is it the equivalent of a guy who has like a accountancy job during the week, but then on the weekends he goes out and gets drunk with his rugby bros and becomes a complete nutter? Or is he a complete nutter all the time?
I think he's a complete...
I'm assuming he's a complete nutter all the time, but it'll be interesting if that's how the, like, series ends.
Well,
guys, back to the desk job, off I go.
Yeah, we've got budgets to balance.
I've got to go back to my wife and make some heirs. Ugh.
I think he does what... The thing is with this feudalism malarkey is that, like, you can actually outsource all of the boring bits of the jobs. So, you know, you just get an assistant or whatever, and they take care of all of the boring stuff for you, I assume. Like, Robert was a bit like that, you know? Robert liked a good tourney, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the Baratheon way. The Baratheons do seem to have traits of that kind of bromanship. You know, they're all...
They're very bro-y.
Except for Stannis. Yeah.
And this is the introvert of the family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because like, even Renly was... me and Rosie were rewatching Game of Thrones. It was apparent on, certainly on my like what fifth rewatch or whatever, how good of a king Renly would have made.
It was just nice.
That's all it takes sometimes, isn't it?
Like, just being a nice and respectful human being.
Mm.
Oh, what a different world it would be.
Yeah, yeah. Just someone who wants to do a good job, you know? It's not really a lot. It's not, the bar's not really that high. Just it just seemed, but also like that entire like segment of the aristocracy. You know, Loras Tyrell, I'm not going to say that Loras Tyrell was a man of the people, but he was appreciated
by the younger ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think the older politicians, if somehow Loras had somehow made it up into the line of succession to be king, he would have been perfectly adequate because he would have been likable enough, you know, in front of the banners or whatever. The people would have thought he was very nice and kind and sweet. And in the meantime, he would have been very easily controlled by his, political allies.
Well,
wouldn't have done much. But like, if Marjorie and Olenna would have had input into his like policy and procedures, and like even suggesting people to put into the into his direct court and into the into the eye of the king, he could have made a perfectly respectable king, same as Renly. It's a shame.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think if Renly had become king, Loras would have almost certainly have been Kingsguarded.
Mm. Oh, yeah, 100%.
Along with Brienne.
He would have been Kingsguarded and then spent a lot of the nights guarding his king. Polishing his sword while remaining celibate.
Doesn't count if it's in the bum. So, it depends. Some interpretation is, it depends.
Well,
how
we were
talking
about that with House of the Dragon, where Rhaenyra. Oh my god! All the names for House of the Dragon have completely gone out of my brain. Main princess in House of the Dragon, Rhaenyra, who said that quote unquote Daemon never touched her, when clearly they'd been doing some heavy petting. Mm. It wasn't penetrative. Question mark? Question mark? Question mark?
Yeah, like it's just
people's interpretation of sex acts.
Yeah, well, sort of, kind of, maybe, I guess. It's open to interpretation, I suppose. But
in chastity cultures.
Yeah, I mean, what's a hand job between friends, right?
Anyway, didn't he get all freaked out when she was like, "Yeah, I'm game," and then ran away?
Yeah, yeah.
That's why she then jumped on Kristen.
So yeah, yeah, she got herself all horned up and it was like nowhere to go. Like, oh.
Yeah, nowhere to go except the Kingsguard.
Which actually, have we talked about this before? I remember talking about this with someone where like Kristen Cole actually like, I feel really bad for him. And actually I think
we were talking about this last podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we were
talking about it being workplace sexual harassment at minimum.
I mean, but also like that aside, the one, and he says this like directly, the one thing he had to his name was his station that was insulted and sullied and,
he was stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Badunch.
Yes, pun intended.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I kind of feel bad for him, like, all the way through. Like, yeah, he's a bit of an asshole at times, but, like, man, the guy has the right to be honest. Like, he is watching dragons at war for the first time in a generation. And I'm like, yeah, that's gonna kind of humble you. And you're not treated with the respect that you're for the station that you spent your whole life working towards. So I don't know, I feel like he can't catch. He's like basically he's a person with the mindset of a common folk, and he has to like he can't get his head around how
he doesn't have Yeah, he doesn't have the power or the training to interact with the politics of the gentry.
Yeah, it's a bit like how I think about like the Epstein files, right? Like everyone always wonders why if all these people knew about like Epstein or at least strongly suspected or whatever, did they go along with it? And my guess is because it's a class system thing. If you are in that upper echelon, if you're of the billionaire class, right? Nobbling a few kids is just, it's just what they do. It's just normal for them. To us, it seems horrifying because we are the common folk. Like, it's just like, you know, they set the rules. We follow the rules. They don't have to follow. That's why they're aristocratic. That's why, you know, they have aircrafts that fly them around wherever they want, whenever they want. That's why they've got 100 houses and they've got staff of hundreds surrounding them every day about telling them exactly what they want to hear. And the vast majority of people that you talk to day in, day out, you know, they rely on you for their livelihood. It does, you know, all of that stuff, it does something to the brain. But like, you know, I feel like one of the quote unquote joys of being in the aristocracy is that you do stuff that is, you know, you can walk through doors that are just not open to the vast, vast, vast majority of people. That's what's so great about it. You don't have to abide by the rules that you set because you are, you know, another kind of, you know, you don't have to. It's just as simple as that, really. And I think that's a bit like the Targaryens. It's like they can do incest. They can marry as many people as they want. They can kill whoever they want. They can burn down cities and villages on a whim. But they'll tell
puppeteers if
exactly
they offend them.
Yeah, but but the second that someone else certainly points, you know, does anything like that in their direction, least of all a common folk, it's entirely different. Which is what we see here. Like, yeah, you know, Arian Brightframe, unpopular, hated, and then just. And I think he might have had his ego a little bit bruised by what happened on the joust, right? Like, he probably didn't like people booing him and throwing stones at him and having to be protected, and so he's a bit like. Embarrassed because of that, and then he goes into the tent to watch this play, and they're talk, you know, the dragons are insulted, and you know, he flips his shit like a little spoiled bully, because that's what he is.
He kind of feels like he's just wanting attention of his dad, so he would have found something to get a fight in, because he wanted to.
He just wanted to hurt someone. He's just like a Joffrey. Really, isn't he?
Yeah. It's very interesting, though, with the... I think I can't remember whether or not it was something on Instagram or something, but someone pointed out that, like, instead of it being, like, a Joffrey scream fest, him being like, you dead, hit the prince, blah, 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 he's all very, like, calm with it, being like, well, you just throwing your life away, dude. That's on you, I guess. You loosened my toupe. Like, he was very, like... kind of like he's got, I think, a level of kind of apathy, both apathy towards the poor, but like apathy towards just life in general. He seems to just be like, I just want to, like, he can't, like, it's an interesting characterization for someone who he obviously, you know, a not a nice person and you don't like him immediately. But there's also just a level of just disinterest, like the. Like everything's below him, which is fun to obviously counteract with Duncan the Tall, because Duncan is not below him.
I think so. I think there's a mix of feelings here. I think part of it is confusion. Like, I think he genuinely was like, why? Like, you've hit a prince. Like, you're just going to die now. We all know this. Why? Like, it's not stopping her from getting hurt. You've just killed yourself. Why? Because maybe he's just so used to people just falling in line, and this is someone that, he has an overwhelming sense of justice, right? Like to the point where he just
ran on instinct.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it's a part of him.
So I did. I like the way that that was shot with him just like pretty much just seeing red.
Yeah,
it was good. It was good. It wasn't like it was very sincere. I do enjoy the general sincerity of the series so far.
Yeah,
like it's refreshing.
Ah, the Fosse. The whole beat towards it is just amazing. Like the Fosse Away guy,
We're talking about all Maker's kids, and then Egg comes in when he's
like, and the youngest.
Really good timing, editing it all. It really flows really good.
Yeah, but then also like the whole atmosphere of the shots change. Like, you know, it's like when, you know, you feel comfortable, you know, things, you know, you're having a good time, and then suddenly like something in the air changes from like levity to like absolute seriousness and disaster. And
I kind of want to rewatch the scene slowly to see whether or not, like, it feels like an adjustment in the frame rate. It's that sort of a vibe.
It's just the camera goes from like a fixed still camera to then like that sort of handheld over the shoulder kind of view. There's a lot more zooming. There's a lot more depth to the motion of the shots. The camera becomes a lot more shaky. The shots cut from one to the other a lot quicker. And there's like little things about it as well. Like you can see, is it the Kingsguard emptying out that pollen that they use for the dragon? Like it's just the shots become so much more dynamic. And then they slow right back down when Dunk's being sort of apprehended. Like I remember at the time, like it felt very fluid to the mood of the scene. So you had the car, like the joyful bit, him and Fosse Away. Then you had, you know, Egg running in and him running out, shaky cam, lots of cutting, a lot of the light being sort of I think the light generally remained the same throughout the scenes, and then the camera work slowed down again when it became tense but not dramatic.
It's well directed. I've got to say, like, we say almost every single thing, but like the direction and the blocking and the sets and the scenery and the EP work has never been at fault in Game of Thrones as a franchise.
No, but I feel like this was a particularly good set. I will say
some of the stuff in this one is beautiful.
Mm.
Like, this series.
Yeah. Well, what I like about this, I like that they don't have dragons. Like, to me, this makes it, but you know, almost better, really. It makes it more interesting. And
more human.
More human.
More relatable.
More relatable, more complex. And, but also, like, so them bringing down the budget so they can't rely on the big spectacle means that they do tend to focus on, because I mean, I don't know what the budget is for this, but I'm guessing it's a lot.
I can't remember. There's a beautiful quote I heard recently, and I can't remember where I've heard it from, but it was something along the lines of like limitations are is fuel for creativity.
Yeah.
Something along those lines, which I think is yes, absolutely. Like when you actually have to like work around limitations, means that you have to actually do things correctly and do things like focus on what's important.
So, okay. So a quick search has revealed that A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, the budget per episode was $6 million compared to House of the Dragon, which was $20 million.
Oh my God. I didn't realize it was that high for House of the Dragon.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we've had no animated dragon. So I imagine a huge chunk of that budget is that. And also Matt Smith. Let's be honest, Matt Smith is probably racking up a pay slip.
Oh, yeah, because there weren't that many big names in this, are there?
I don't know any big names in this.
I don't know any of them. I don't recognize any of these actors.
We looked it up before it came out, and I think the only actor that had any accreditation that we could find was Baratheon.
I think
he was an obscure person that we're like, oh, well, maybe he was in a thing that I might have seen.
Yeah, I'm just looking through the...
That's nice. Like, it's nice to not have... Like, because I remember even finding that when I first started watching Game of Thrones. Like, everyone watched Game of Thrones, at least initially, because of Sean Bean and perhaps because of Lena Headey.
Oh, yeah, I like Lena Headey. Yeah, well, there was loads. There's Mark Addy. Charles Dance.
Charles Dance. So obviously, he didn't come in until later, but, like,
if you think episode four, he was still in season one.
Still season one, but he wasn't, like, an initial, like, watch the pilot draw.
No, I guess not. The guy that plays Stannis Baratheon, that's season two.
So, like, you know, but that there was a draw of known actors, while this is really not. And I think even with, as I said, every single Game of Thrones series seems to get a better understanding of what is actually needed for the story.
Yeah.
And, like, having Matt Smith was great. It is great in House of the Dragon. It's lovely to have on screen. He's holding up a lot of some interesting writing choices through pure charisma and dedication to the part. But having this, where none of the actors are people that I've heard of or know anything from, and immediately I really love the characters. It's not about the actors, it's about the characters. It's really nice.
It's a lot easier to get lost in the world when you're not like, oh, I know that guy from that thing.
Oh, that guy from that one, yeah.
So interestingly enough...
It's a doctor in a blonde wig. That's weird.
So I'm just looking through the actors. Dexter Solansel, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, who plays Egg, has got a few credits. He's in The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbird and Snakes. I don't know I've heard of The Hunger Games.
That's one of the late sequels. Like that's one of the movies that came out one or 2 years ago.
That's a prequel. It's the 10th Hunger Games. The Hunger Games in the first book is the 74th Hunger Games. So it's 64 years. It takes place 64 years before the first Hunger Games. I actually really like those books and those movies.
Was that a film or was it a series?
Well, they made four movies for the original trilogy, and they've made the first prequel into a movie, Ballad of Songbird and Snakes, and then the next prequel,
another prequel coming out soon. Yeah,
yeah, the book is out, and that was good.
He was also in Emmerdale, which I don't know if you know what Emmerdale is, Max. But it's
can't say I've heard of it. By Jenny's laugh, it must be something.
It's a British soap.
Do you know what's amusing? I've just looked up Emmerdale on IMDb. Right, this is amazing. They don't have. So technically, Emmerdale is on series one.
So they've never had a break.
Because they've never... Well, it's all one series.
How many episodes?
It's episode 10,500.
10,500. Is it like... They have like a new episode every day or every weekday or something?
It's like three times a week or something like that?
Three times a week for like the last...
20, 40...
30 years?
Yeah, 30 years.
So the longest running American soap, which is still running, is General Hospital, and that's over 15,000 episodes.
Okay. How many episodes in EastEnders? One sec.
Yeah. So it's 10,500. Episode one was in 1972.
Oh wow!
So we're talking 54 years ago. So
Do you think people go back and watch like old soaps? Do you think there's like super soap fans that are like
must be right?
Okay, so apparently,
it's impossible. Some of these must be lost to time, right? Especially the BBC back in the 60s.
Coronation Street with 11,700 episodes since 1960. Emmerdale with 10,000 and EastEnders with 7,000.
Oh, 7,273.
So Coronation Street is winning.
Yeah, I think Coronation Street is the longest running UK soap.
Yeah. Hollyoaks is basically a baby with only starting in 1995. It's only going for 30 years.
Well, there we go.
The millennial show.
I do not like EastEnders. I do not like any of these. Oh, but one thing I did notice about Night of the Seven Kingdoms, though. So this episode, 9.1 out of 10 on IMDb.
Oh, nice.
Which is good to see. And the show as a whole, I think, is doing pretty well. It's like, what is it as a whole? Did I see it as being like eight something?
Goes to show more egg, more joy, right?
Basically, yeah. 8.4 out of 10, which I would give this. See, the first episode was a bit of a, like, it was a bit like just getting to grips with things, a bit slow, a bit setting everything up. But if you take it as a whole, I would be hard pressed not to give this a 10 out of 10. You know,
it's, sure.
You know, easy 9, maybe a 10.
9 out of 10 for definite. I will say I do enjoy the fact that this series does tension but not dread. Like, I'm really enjoying that emotion. I feel like Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon were just so full of dread.
Yeah.
And this has tension. Like, you feel for the characters that they could go wrong. They're making difficult decisions that have consequences.
Yeah.
I think because the stakes are so much smaller generally. You're not like, oh God, the world is going to end because so-and-so said something to someone. You're like, oh shit, this could go wrong, huh? Mm-hmm. Ah.
Yeah, but also the I think part of it is that we know that Dunk survives, right? Like, we know.
I mean,
is that a spoiler? We know this because there's at least
we know he makes it into the Kingsguard and that he has 4 pages written about him.
Yeah.
In the book, you know, that's pretty. I mean, I don't consider that a spoiler.
I think you're pretty safe.
Yeah. So I think. Yeah, I think this. I don't think this can have dread, really.
Yeah.
Not that it needs dread.
I would hope not.
No, it's not
that it doesn't need it. I think it's good to be able to have a compelling story without having to have dread.
Yeah, mild peril, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe substantial peril in places, but yeah, it's.
Yeah.
But it's not about that. It's as well. It's you know, it's Ivanhoe. It's a Knight's. Okay, we shouldn't say it's a Knight's Tale because the Knight's Tale came after this. So that's, yeah. Did we discover that last episode or something?
I can't remember having that conversation with you guys. But,
I might have had it with Rosie, to be honest. But like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a Knight's Tale actually came after Night. I am absolutely shocked that Seven Kingdoms was written as long ago as it was.
Mm.
But the book is yeah, I believe it is older than A Knight's Tale. So we're not allowed to say it. We shouldn't say it's based on A Knight's Tale. If anything, Knight's Tale's based on this. Oh, and also the catchphrase, or not the catchphrase, the motto for the show is "A tall tale that became legend."
Aww.
Which is kind of cool.
My clothing shout out for the episode, because I have to have at least one clothing shout out, is I really like Doug's padded vest. I think it's a good way of showing layering in historical clothing. And I also like the fact that you can see some of his stitch work on his like main shirt, where he's clearly like darned, which, given they had the whole scene with sewing,
that's
pretty nifty. Also, the horse armor is excellent.
Yeah, see, this is what's quite interesting is that, see, on a very superficial, childish level, Arian Brightflame's armor is kind of cool, but and I think they do this on purpose in Game of Thrones, is the, if you've got cool armor, you're probably a bit of
an arsehole.
Yeah, because even Daemon is you know, he did that as well. And the other Targaryen, the one that isn't quite as good at fighting, that he was a bit worried about being called out, he had like much nicer armor. It was kind of slicker. It wasn't dragony. It was just like, it's almost a little bit, I don't want to say, like, yeah, like futuristic or modern.
I enjoyed the armor of the other competitor, the one whose horse died, like that.
Oh, that was good armor too. Yeah. I'm just gonna try and Yeah, this is the armor that I thought was kind of good. I'm just popping that in the chat. Yeah, that armor looked kind of cool.
I like how it somewhat matches the Kingsguard armor. The Kingsguard armor have got lots of kind of got a roundness to the Kingsguard armor for this generation.
Well, I actually felt that the King, particularly with the helmets on, they looked a bit like clanny. You like Ku Klux Klanny.
I haven't made that much of a connection yet, but
it reminded me of dragons in the way, the shape and the texture.
It's the whiteness and I think the spikes on the head or something like that. They just kind of looked a bit. Just a little bit clanny.
Spike on the head.
I can see it.
Yeah, there's a little like pin on the head. Not pin on the head, you know, spike on the head, yeah.
Okay, just I didn't notice.
It's,
but that picture that you just posted in a chat, he talks about the guy that didn't get called out by Arian, his cousin, that's Valar, who is Baelor's son, so he would be second in line to the throne.
Oh, okay. And obviously something happens to him. We're not going to be seeing the fire at Summerhall unless they do
have it for another 60 years.
They very much jump the shark
or jump the time.
Yeah. I feel like if they were to present that like in the show, it'd be hard to go back to cute young Duncan Egg off on their adventures.
They could do it. I mean, they probably won't, but they could do it as like a movie or something, just like with a completely different cast in a completely different way. I do wonder if there's ever if they're going to try and do a movie or they're going to stick to series.
I think, given how much we've enjoyed having the time to get to know these characters, I don't know if a movie would be able to hold.
Not necessarily a Duncan Egg movie. All right, I'll tell you what.
Any movie wouldn't be able to capture a good enough character story that can be concisely told.
Okay, what about this then? What event or events or period of time, if you had to make a movie, would you choose?
Aegon's Conquest.
That would fit into a movie. Yeah, that could fit well into a movie.
What's West of Westeros?
Quite possibly.
The Arya story, how she's getting killed by butterflies.
Arya's adventures, taking diseases across the world.
It's more pockets.
Yeah, Game of Thrones does colonialism again.
Oh, jeez.
It could be adventures in a shy, something to do like that, like sea snake goes to a shy on holiday, beach episode.
Pie's baking hour.
Oh yeah, hot pie's baking hour, or
life in the day of it's Pounce, King Pounce,
Sir Pounce. Yeah, origin story of the great of the High Sparrow. I've got it. No, this is the good one. Okay, so is it the one at the wall?
The journey at
The wall, the one, the Shadow Tower one, the little story in the Lord Commander that takes a white as his wife. Do you know that like story?
The myth one. I think the tourney at Harrenhal.
Yeah, that could be a good one as well. Yeah,
that is like it could. Yeah. It's basically just a love story, but with a lot of political intrigue on top. So that could maybe be told in a movie.
I don't know if you could really do Robert's Rebellion because that's just battle after battle after battle. I don't think it'd be that interesting. Yeah. But
your heroes for that is, given what we learn about Rob's relationship with
Lyanna.
Lyanna, are you really voting? Who are you voting to win in that? Because by nature of movie, it has to be quite a concise, short story. you kind of need a protagonist. So you could say Ned's your protagonist, but he's not really like fighting Robert's rebellion. He's participating. He's like a second in command, but he's not like the protagonist. So are you meant to be on Robert's side, or are you meant to be on, are you meant to be on the side of the lovers, question mark, whose actual relationship status is a little bit BBC anyway?
I don't know. Maybe.
I think a movie, because the Game of Thrones world is so
layered,
layered, and one of the things I enjoy about specifically this series and House of the Dragon to a similar extent is because of the groundwork done for building the physical realm, the languages, the basic politics, the family kind of heritage, and the political structure of the ruling elite.
Yep.
You can actually get into some other things in House of the Dragon and this.
Yeah.
I don't think you could concisely summarize that whole thing in a movie if you want to try and get it so that new audiences could theoretically understand it, which you have to kind of be able to play the field in both directions.
Yeah.
To make a new movie, you've got to be able to appeal to both new people and to fans. You have to reiterate the story as you go, or just assume they know the answers. It has to be a very concise story set in the world of Song of Ice and Fire to be able to do that preamble without it just being like, I don't know, a black scrolling page of exposition to kick off the movie, which no one will like.
Yeah. I mean, this is six episodes of half an hour-ish each. That's a long movie in terms of time anyway.
Yeah.
But I do like the fact that this is a better structure for it because it feels a little bit more day by day, and it lets it sink in bit by bit. And I actually really kind of like
really
that.
Enjoying the pacing.
Yeah. So, yeah. There is one bit we haven't really covered. Plumber is asking, I got to remember this one now. Is Plumber asking Dunk to take a fall, or is he?
No, he's asking. He's asking.
He says
that his guy is going to take a fall, and he wants Dunk to call this guy out so that they can arrange
for him to
take fight, so Dunk can win.
That's it. Yeah,
and they can bet on him as an underdog with good odds, and then make money.
Yeah,
which is it's a bit of a like it's the more honorable thing to ask someone to cheat by doing because wants to win anyway, and he's technically not taking a fall. He just knows that his competitor is taking a fall. So annoyingly, you know, the ironic thing is, I'm sure if Poole went to him and went, "Oh, I think you're well fitted to challenge this guy. Maybe you should challenge this guy. He'll be a good fit." And Dunk would probably have put his heart into it, given it his best shot, and the other guy would have taken a fall. And Dunk wouldn't have needed to know the moral quandary. But because he's come to him in advance and gone, "Oh, why don't you do this guy because we can make it a bit sneaky, sneaky," he's immediately going to be like, "No, I don't want to do that."
Yeah,
the question that we get to see Dunk like grapple with, and like he gets to there gets to be the moment of him being like, "I don't want to do that. I want to, you know, win with honor." But he's not going to end up having to go through with this anyway.
Because he's going to be arrested, presumably.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're not going to let that one slide, are they? Well, I mean, this is the big bit of the series. This is what it's about, is what, you know, done here. So I'm trying to work out where Plumber falls in the sort of the political hierarchy of Westeros. Is he, because like the Ashfords are a lower house,
and he's their steward. I think he's pretty much he would be a non-player except for the fact that he's wanting to make sure that this tourney is a success.
So he's really more of an employee than a player.
Yeah,
because I'm trying to think like. Yeah, he probably doesn't do this very much, right? I don't know. Like, this is it a case of, like, is he expecting some sort of, like, commoner to be given this opportunity to unseat a lord? Like, is he expecting him to like jump at the chance of this potential boost, because like, you know, it's maybe this kind of thing is a bit more commonplace amongst the aristocracy. Are they more likely, you know, are they more used to taking fixing fights, basically?
I think you know, Unks are very good at sea for an underdog bet.
Yeah.
Because he is completely unheard of. He's a completely neutral bet in terms of his status.
Yeah, he is just an absolute underdog. The odds on him would be...
would be insane. And yeah, he's presumably physically capable, judging from his height and his like strength. Now, whether or not he's actually skilled, that's an assumption depending on how it turns out. We genuinely don't know. He could be terrible at Lance.
Yeah, but he's
by
big.
The fact that his horse hasn't even learnt to run properly, I don't think he's going to be very good at it.
But he's big. He's big.
That's something, but that, you know, that maybe doesn't necessarily assist with doing actual jousting. I don't know what skills or what physical things are useful. Jousting, I don't know how much of it is the speed of your horse or how much is your coordination, how much is your strength versus how much is your aim. I genuinely do not know. But I think it's one of those things that's interesting that I think I mentioned it in episode 1 or 2. Right now, because he's a complete unknown and kind of the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
He's really, like, when people try and using him as a chip, he's kind of a low value chip, so you can kind of throw him at the wall and see what happens. You can put him on the table, and if you win or lose the bet,
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't really matter what happens to him, and the consequences are going to be comparatively low.
Yeah.
But if he were to climb the ranks and become more politically valuable, then he would become a much more dangerous piece to use, abuse, manipulate. And that would be a very different... very different state of affairs. So, like, the fact that he is being asked to do this is a very low level playing.
Yeah.
It's poker. It's blind poker.
Yeah, I think I guess this is more to do with the fact that Dunk is becoming increasingly disenfranchised with what it means to be a knight, and obviously the big theme of this episode is that Dunk, who is not a real knight, really, and if he is a real knight, he's a shitty hedge knight that So he is, you know, he has the characteristics of an ideal knight, but not the background or pedigree or training or any of that stuff. And then
then all of the true knights, quote unquote, are not real knights either.
Exactly. Because whilst they are knights on paper, they do not hold the characteristics of honesty, chivalry, protecting the vulnerable, etc., etc. So that's, you know, and he's just, this is him facing it eye to eye at this point, I guess.
Yeah. It's been a very interesting, like, as I said at the beginning, like, the first 2/3 of this episode are pure delight, and the last third of this episode is moving forward in a way that's really interesting.
I mean, not even the last third, the last, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's just, like, it all, yeah. The way that it... The way that it all shifts.
I'm really excited about the next episode. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Cool. All right, should we wrap it up there?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I was like, oh, we haven't talked about this.
Well...
I think we pretty much covered it.
We've pretty much covered it frame by frame, really. I mean, we spent over 90 minutes on a 30-minute episode. So,
I mean, how long did we spend on the trailer?
Ah, that's fair, yeah. Cool.
Well, anyway.
Right, anyway, yeah.
I liked it. I'm excited to watch the next episode, which
I'm going
to
do
might put in the background.
Right now. Cool, all right. Yeah, if either of you if both of you are about this weekend, give me a shout. I'll try and make some time if you are. But no pressure. If you want to do it in a week or whenever you're free, then we'll...
Might be free Sunday. Saturday's looking quite busy for me.
Cool, Sunday.
Yeah, me too. So that will probably work out then for Sunday.
Awesome. All right. Cool. Cool. No pressure if, you know, stuff comes up, but we'll, you know, do what we can, I guess. Cool. All right. Well, I'll round off the podcast there. So thank you everyone for listening. Toodaloo.
Bye.
Bye.